The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Deborah Love from the North Carolina Reading Service, and I am the host and producer for today's episode of Health Issues. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. Today, we'll be focusing on breathing issues, starting with sleep apnea and moving to COPD. First, sleep apnea. John Bishop was visiting his cardiologist to discuss his high blood pressure. During the visit, he mentioned his wife commenting on his snoring. The cardiologist suggested he do an overnight sleep test, which revealed startling results. He averaged 52 pauses in breathing an hour, a notably high number. His blood oxygen levels had dipped as low as 82% during the night. In this test, values under 90% are considered low. John was diagnosed with obstructive sleep apnea. The condition affects an estimated 15% of older adults and occurs more commonly in those who, like John, have other cardiovascular conditions or are overweight. The sleep specialist prescribed a continuous positive airway pressure, or CPAP, device. Eventually, John found a CPAP mask that worked and was comfortable to wear all night. The mask, plus significant weight loss thanks to changed diet and exercise routines, caused a dramatic improvement in both his blood pressure and his energy levels. If you have sleep apnea, you likely feel sleepy or fatigued during the day, especially after lunch, while driving, or during periods of inactivity. You may wake in the morning with a headache and feel mentally dull, with a sense that your sleep wasn't refreshing. Other symptoms include high blood pressure, irritability, insomnia, decreased sex drive, irregular heartbeats, and dry mouth. During sleep, the muscles in the back of the throat relax. These muscles keep the airway open by providing support to structures in the mouth and throat, such as the small teardrop-shaped tissue at the back of the throat, which is known as the uvula, the soft palate, the tonsils, and the tongue. With obstructive sleep apnea, these structures collapse and obstruct airflow. Obstruction of airflow leads to lower oxygen levels in your blood. After 10 to 30 seconds of insufficient exchange of air, your brain senses the problem and rouses you to a lighter level of sleep or brief wakefulness. The muscles then regain their usual tone. The obstruction is relieved, possibly with a snort, and you resume breathing. This temporary stop in breathing is called apnea. This pattern can repeat itself dozens to hundreds of times each night, though many with sleep apnea aren't aware of these interruptions and think they sleep well. The repetitive obstructions prevent you from reaching the deep restorative phases of sleep and lead to tiredness during the day. Obstructive sleep apnea can happen to anyone at any age. However, it's diagnosed more often in people who are overweight and in men. The condition also becomes more common in women after menopause. Untreated sleep apnea can lead to other challenges, including with your weight and your mood. One of the serious consequences of daytime sleepiness is an increased risk of accidents while driving or at work. In addition, trouble concentrating and lack of energy can challenge your productivity and relationships. The drops in blood oxygen levels that occur with apnea also lead to increased blood pressure and strain on the cardiovascular system. Obstructive sleep apnea has been linked to high blood pressure, coronary artery disease, heart attack, heart failure, heart rate changes, stroke, blood clots, and diabetes. The Mayo Clinic advises, do not ignore the snore. See your healthcare team if you or a bed partner has noticed any of these symptoms. 1. Pauses in breathing during sleep. 2. Snoring that's loud enough to disturb another person's sleep or wake you up from sleep. Or 3. Excessive daytime drowsiness, which may cause you to fall asleep while you're working, watching television, or driving. Sometimes testing for sleep apnea can be performed in your home, but a sleep study in a sleep clinic is often needed to confirm and optimize treatment for obstructive sleep apnea. Because treatments for sleep disorders differ, it's important to obtain an accurate diagnosis and fully understand your sleep condition. But here are some self-care things to keep in mind. Some lifestyle measures may help keep your airway open during sleep, so you could try these tips. You might change your sleep position. Sleeping on your back can cause your tongue and soft palate to rest against the back of your throat and block your airway. To stop yourself from sleeping on your back, try sewing a pocket or sock on the back of your pajamas and placing a tennis ball inside. There are also commercially available devices and specially shaped pillows to prevent you from sleeping on your back. You might avoid triggers. Alcohol, sedatives, and sleeping pills further relax the muscles in the back of the throat and can make sleep apnea worse. Or you might move more and weigh less. Even small reductions in excess weight, when maintained, can produce long-lasting improvements in sleep apnea, blood pressure, and quality of life. Regular exercise improves sleep apnea as well as quality of sleep. So let's talk about masking and other options. Often, self-care measures alone don't provide adequate relief for sleep apnea. Your healthcare team likely will encourage you to try other treatments. Among those are positive airway pressure. This is generally the first-line treatment for obstructive sleep apnea. The most studied, reliable device is one that applies continuous positive airway pressure, CPAP, through a mask you put over your nose. The mask is connected to a machine that increases the pressure of the air you breathe. The pressure is just enough to keep your upper airway passages open, preventing apnea events. This form of treatment can cut out snoring, dramatically improve the quality of your sleep, eliminate daytime sleepiness, and may help lower your blood pressure. Many different types of masks are available. Some styles don't cover the nose or mouth, but rather sit under your nose, or use soft prongs that go into the nostrils. With a little experimenting and by working with a sleep care specialist, most people find a CPAP mask that provides a comfortable and secure fit. Once a suitable mask is found, most people appreciate how much better they feel when they use it. CPAP devices have a variety of comfort features which can reduce the pressure as you exhale, as well as warm and moisten the air for comfort. Some units provide adjustable levels of pressure. There are also oral appliances. For mild to moderate obstructive sleep apnea, wearing a dental appliance designed to open your throat by bringing your jaw and tongue slightly forward at night may be an option. The oral appliances need to be worn every night. Still, regular follow-up with your sleep care specialist and dentist is important to assure that you're getting the right kind of therapy. There is medication. In late 2024, the Food and Drug Administration approved tirzepatide, also known as Zepbound, as the first prescription medication to treat obstructive apnea. The drug is indicated for people with obesity in addition to moderate to severe sleep apnea. And lastly, there's surgery. If a CPAP machine isn't right for you and you don't benefit from other treatments, your care team may recommend surgery to keep your airway open or increase the size of your airway. Several procedures are available, including removing some of the soft tissues at the back of the throat, repositioning the jaw, or implanting an electronic device that stimulates the nerves that keep your airway open. Work with your care team to decide which procedure is right for you. Continuing in the theme of breathing issues, this next article is about surgical treatments for COPD. When was the last time you had to think about breathing? For most people, inhaling and exhaling is second nature. But for those living with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, breathing isn't something to take for granted. COPD describes a group of progressive lung diseases that includes emphysema and chronic bronchitis. As the name implies, COPD obstructs airflow, making it more difficult to exhale and often causing breathlessness, especially during physical activity. As a result, you may have difficulty completing or enjoying daily tasks and can experience symptoms such as wheezing, chest tightness, a rounded chest shape, also known as barrel chest, and chronic cough. COPD is typically caused by long-term exposure to harmful chemicals or fumes. Smoking is the leading cause of COPD. Rarely, however, emphysema is caused by an inherited protein deficiency, alpha-1 antitrypsin, or AAT, deficiency, or it may occur in some forms of systemic autoimmune conditions. Numerous management strategies exist for COPD, including inhalers and oxygen therapy. For many years, doctors thought there were no viable surgical ways to treat COPD, says Mayo Clinic thoracic surgeon Stephen Cassivi, MD. However, effective surgical options have recently emerged. There are four main surgical options for COPD. Determining whether you are a good fit for surgery depends on a number of factors, including your age and overall fitness level, your type of COPD and its progression, the severity of your symptoms, and the effectiveness of lifestyle interventions, medications, and non-surgical treatment options you've tried. So one option is lung volume reduction surgery. With emphysema, the lungs commonly become hyperextended, and these overinflated portions compress healthier parts of the lungs, making it hard to breathe. In lung volume reduction surgery, the non-functioning parts are removed, allowing healthier portions more room to expand and function. Imagine your lungs as a tree in a glass jar. With emphysema, the lower portions of the tree are compressed and crowded by the damaged upper portions. The idea is that we are pruning the tree, said Dr. Cassivi. Lung volume reduction can help some people live better and longer with COPD, but it isn't a cure. This surgery works best for people who have distinct areas of lung damage rather than spread out or diffuse damage. Another option is endobrachial valve surgery. This surgery, sometimes called endoscopic lung volume reduction, also focuses on decreasing the lung's size to improve breathing. A slender scope is inserted through the mouth, is used to place small endobrachial valves in the overinflated lobes of lungs. These valves help trapped air to leave the lungs, and over time, the damaged portion deflates. This procedure also allows the healthier portion of the lung more room to expand and function. Both lung volume reduction and endobrachial valve surgeries are considered minimally invasive. This means that these procedures are easier on the body, require less time in the hospital, and are linked to less pain when compared with open surgeries. Another option is bullectomy. COPD can damage small air sacs, known as alveoli, in the lungs. Over time, the lungs may be left with large pockets of air rather than clusters of alveoli. These air pockets, called bullae, can trap old air in the lungs, compress portions of the lungs, and affect breathing. A bullectomy is a type of surgery that removes the bullae to improve lung function and airflow. Bullectomy may be performed as an open surgery or as a minimally invasive procedure. One type of less invasive procedure, called video-assisted thoracoscopic surgery, or VATS, includes one or more small incisions in the chest. A small camera is temporarily inserted into the chest to guide the surgery. Lastly, there's lung transplant. Finally, some people may be eligible for a lung transplant. With a transplant, we take out the damaged lungs and replace them with healthier lungs, said Dr. Kasivi. In general, transplant is a very good treatment for emphysema in those who qualify. However, the procedure comes with important considerations, such as the potential for serious complications and the need for lifelong medications that suppress the immune system to decrease the risk of organ rejection. A transplant is a major surgery with notable risks, but for some people, it's the best option to make breathing easier and improve quality. If you have COPD and are having trouble breathing, reach out to your healthcare team to discuss your options. Living with COPD doesn't mean you have to accept breathing difficulty or discomfort as inevitable part of getting older. More and more, there are treatments to keep you feeling better for longer, said Dr. Kasivi. Now for a change of pace, this article is in relation to a question that a reader wrote. Years ago, I got a tattoo. Now I wish I hadn't. Can my tattoo be removed safely? I've heard the process can be quite painful. The answer? If you're wishing you had done a little more thinking before inking, you're not alone. Or perhaps your tattoo was meaningful in another phase of life, but is now unwanted. As more Americans get tattoos, about 32% of adults have one, regrets are growing. Among people with tattoos, 18 to 30% say they wish they hadn't gotten them. A tattoo is meant to be permanent. The ink is placed beneath the surface of your skin in the second skin layer called the dermis, so it doesn't disappear with normal shedding of skin cells. But that also makes the ink more complicated to remove. Still, there are ways to lighten and in some cases remove an unwanted tattoo. The first step is to talk to a dermatologist or other skincare professional about whether you're a good candidate for tattoo removal. The size, color, and location of your tattoo, as well as your skin color, all affect the outcome. The skincare professional can help you understand what's involved and what to expect. This can include possible side effects, such as scarring or discoloration of the skin. A common way to remove or lighten a tattoo is through laser treatment using Q-switched lasers. These emit a pulse of energy that breaks the tattoo ink into tiny pieces. Over several weeks, your body's immune system eliminates the ink particles. It's true that laser tattoo removal can be somewhat painful. Some liken it to the sensation of snapping a thin rubber band against the skin. If the pain is bothersome, a numbing cream can be applied to the skin beforehand. After a treatment, the area around your tattoo may be swollen, and your skin may blister or bleed. Several treatments over time may be needed to lighten or remove the tattoo, with a few weeks between treatments for your skin to heal. Often it's not possible to remove all evidence of a tattoo. The skincare professional can provide reasonable expectations. But after repeat sessions, the tattoo may fade to a level you're happy with. Or you might consider the remaining tattoo, covering the remaining tattoo with a different tattoo. With a multicolored tattoo, you may need treatment with multiple lasers. That's because different colors absorb different energy wavelengths. Dark blue and black inks are easier to remove, while green, red, and yellow are harder. Sometimes there are medical reasons to remove a tattoo. For example, if you have an allergy to the ink or develop a scar over the tattoo. In that situation, your care team would determine the best method to remove the ink. As for at-home removal kits, you may have seen advertised. These are not approved by the Food and Drug Administration. These kits haven't proved to be effective and may sometimes be harmful. And now for some cancer myths versus facts. In previous generations, a cancer diagnosis may have seemed like a death sentence, but long-term survival rates across all types of cancer have significantly improved, from about 49% in the 1970s to close to 70% today. Giant leaps have been made in how medical professionals understand cancer, a term used to describe a group of more than 200 diseases that share certain common features. This knowledge has resulted in major improvements in screening, early detection, and treatment. Because of these breakthroughs, people diagnosed with the most types of cancer, have much better odds of living longer than in previous generations. People with cancer also are better able to remain healthy enough to enjoy life during and after treatment. However, that hopeful picture is still accompanied by a flood of myths, misinformation, and too good to be true products affecting people's understanding. Here are some of the common myths and the facts. Myth: using a smartphone increases the risk of brain cancer and other cancers. Fact: there's no evidence to support this claim. While cell phones do emit radiation, the frequency and energy of that radiation is comparatively very low and not at a level that can affect human DNA. Researchers have noted that in this era, when seemingly everyone has a smartphone, the cancers predicted to be associated with them haven't increased. If you remain concerned about radiation, consider using headphones, earpods, and other devices that will allow you to use your phone without pressing it against your head. Myth: ingredients in antiperspirants and deodorants can cause breast cancer. Fact: some reports have suggested that these products contain harmful substances such as aluminum compounds and parabens that can be absorbed through the skin or enter the body through nicks caused by shaving. But the evidence to date suggests that these products don't cause cancer. Myth: cancers of the colon and rectum mostly are a concern for older adults. Fact: colorectal cancer represents the second highest cause of death among all cancer types in the United States. Although the risk of colorectal cancer is higher as people age, the rate of new colorectal cancer cases is increasing in people under 50. In fact, the rates of colorectal cancer in people under 50 has doubled since 1990. In light of this, it's now recommended that colorectal cancer screening begin at age 45 for people at average risk. In people over 65, the diagnosis rates have been decreasing. This is possibly because of colorectal cancer screening starting earlier, which may lead to higher rates of diagnosis for young people. Here's another myth: microwaving food in plastic containers and wraps releases cancer-causing substances. Fact: there's no clear evidence that you should avoid microwaving plastic containers and wraps labeled as microwave safe. However, it is important to avoid microwaving plastic containers that were never intended for the microwave, such as margarine tubs, takeout containers, or whipped topping bowls. Evidence suggests that plastic containers not intended for use in the microwave could melt and potentially leach chemicals into your food. Another myth, cancer is contagious, and it's best to stay away from someone who has it. Fact, you don't need to avoid someone who has cancer. You can't catch it. It's okay to touch and spend time with someone who has cancer. Your support may never be more valuable. Though cancer itself isn't contagious, some contagious viruses do lead to certain cancers. Examples include human papillomavirus, or HPV, leading to cervical cancer, and both hepatitis B and C leading to liver cancer. Talk to your healthcare team about vaccines and other ways to protect yourself. And finally, another myth, smart people would never fall for bogus cancer products or services. Fact, it's increasingly difficult to avoid exposure to convincing ads for unproven, untested products, and to at least consider them, if not outright fall for them. That's because companies hawking these supposed cures are sophisticated in their marketing efforts, and they're targeting people with a frightening disease who may be vulnerable. The Food and Drug Administration lists common sales pitches used to market sham cancer cures. Watch out for these phrases. Treats all forms of cancer. Miraculously kills cancer cells and tumors. Shrinks malignant tumors. Selectively kills cancer cells. More effective than chemotherapy. Attacks cancer cells, leaving healthy cells intact. Also, be wary of products that point to conspiracy theories, often characterized by language such as what the government won't tell you about. When encountering products with any of these claims, do your best to avoid them and steer others away too. That's all for this week. Please tune in next week when we'll be reading from the Harvard newsletter. We'll be talking about things like pills or patches for pain relief, restless leg syndrome, and we'll be asking the question, or answering the question, whether dark chocolate can help you avoid diabetes. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed this program. I am Deborah Love, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. After its broadcast, you can readily find it as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org, where you'll be able to listen to it again and share it with others. So until next time, if you have any questions or comments, if there are topics you'd particularly like to hear about, please call 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138.